having a little bit of a sound problem tonight, but I think we are back connected and we should be on the air now. So we're just off to a little bit of a late start, but here we go. As usual, I'm starting off with a song.
Okay, maybe now our sound is a little bit better. We've been having a number of technical issues tonight, but hopefully we are up and running now. So, all righty then. I was raised in Texas, schooled in Tennessee. Raised in Texas, schooled in Tennessee. Won't let that woman make a fool out of me. Late last winter, when it was chilling cold. Late last winter, when it was chilling cold. My woman put me out, didn't have nowhere to go. Didn't have no money, my shoes had done worn thin. Didn't have no money, shoes had done worn thin. Didn't have a pair of pants, go to Sunday school in. It's all right, things about to come my way. That's all right, things about to come my way. Got change in my pocket, change of clothes every day. That was a song that was made popular by, it was a lot of people, but I heard it live by a guy named Mance Lipscomb, and I'm kind of featuring music by Mance Lipscomb tonight, so we're going to see what happens there. I'm Chuck Gregory. This is the New American Dream Radio Show, and we are streaming live on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. It's listener-supported radio, so remember to shoot them a donation. This is the last day of the month, so I'm sure they'd appreciate getting over the top there on their goals. And anyhow, I am proud now to introduce my friend and co-host, Mike Palachek, an American writer.
Hello, Chuck. Tonight we welcome these special guests, Rosanna Frechette, Michael Annis, Frank Cordero, and Phil Ferruggio. So this Thursday evening, we are gathering for the New American Dream Radio Show in Fort Lauderdale, in northern Minnesota, in Des Moines, in Port Orange, Florida, in Denver, and wherever you are. My recommended Jim Fetzer's blog. Jack Mullen has an article there. It's entitled Memorial Day, the Banker's Holiday. Bankers cause all modern wars since the days of Napoleon and even before. All major wars have been bankers' wars. Men dying in war are not dying for freedom. They are dying as sacrifices to Talmudic gods, and their sacrifices paid in banker gold. America is fighting wars today in 74 locations around the world. For what? For banking, military, industrial profits, and the softening up of the world's people for their new world order. Peace is a natural state for men and women. The United States has no natural enemies, only Hollywood media incensed, provoked enemies. At this moment, in 74 zones around the world, Americans are in combat, shooting people in Africa, Indonesia, Thailand, Colombia, Peru, and several countries in Eastern and Central Asia. In the Middle East and elsewhere, we are being controlled to our graves by a tiny group of mentally ill vampires sucking the lives out of all of us. Americans at home working around the clock to pay their taxes and interest costs and health care, swindle costs and never-ending fees so that this system of slavery can result in the collapse of all resistance and the destruction of those who could actually stand against these ghouls in order to enrich approximately 8,000 people that control the world. Memorial Day is a hoax created by satanic enslavers to promote that idea that boys and girls murdered and the men, women, and dying collaterally are dying for some reason. They are not. We're all dying to promote a sick, demonic cult into a position where they control the entire world from one seat. We are all dying so this cult can further drastically reduce the population of the world to suit their needs, and for the remaining dumbed down human-like people, they will just be slaves forever. Read the rest at jamesfetzer.blogspot.com, article by Jack Mullen. Our first guest of the show is Frank Cordero. Frank Cordero joins us each week from Des Moines, Iowa, the Des Moines Catholic Worker. And now we're going to hear from Frank Cordero, the conversation between Chuck and Gregory and Frank Cordero.
Hello, Chuck.
Well, hello, Frank.
Apologies to folks. I'm really sorry I missed the calls. By the time I got back to you, I couldn't get a hold of you. So I'm these things happen. So I'm sorry. I hope all went well. It's been a 2-week time frame since we talked. So I'm trying to collect my mind. That was right after we had done our protests at the Iowa Drone Command Center. Two of us got arrested, myself and Elliot Adams, with the Vets for Peace. So in between then and now, just an interesting thing. I put out 4 days ago a news release, and the release said, let me get it out right here. But it's a news release about an altered sign. It said, alert altered U.S. Army billboard in Des Moines, Iowa, quotes, drones kill. Message from Frank Cordero and the American Catholic Worker House. So I put this, I sent it out to all the press. And in the body, I said, we received the below statement with a 1600 Euclid Avenue address today. The artist wishes to remain anonymous. Attached a photo of billboard. Now, the attached photo of billboard, let me describe it. It's a U.S. Army billboard. And half of the picture has its message. Earn respect. And up to $40,000 in bonuses if you qualify. GoArmy.com/Des Moines. Then the other half have two very young military cadet type people hands on a drone, not a killer drone, but you know, a plane that might be a little bigger than you know, plate planes, but it's clearly a drone. The artist using a pink paint underneath the whole of the sign in the middle, drones kill. Sent that out to the Des Moines Register and with this statement, and I do think the statement's worth reading. It says, the time has come to have a conversation about the use of armed drones in the backyard of Des Moines, Iowa. In fact, this conversation is well overdue. Iowans need to break the silence about the killing that is being perpetrated in our city at the Drone Command Center next to the Des Moines International Airport. By letting the Air National Guard Drone Command Center and the 132nd Wing exist in our city, we are failing to publicly condemn an active war zone in which Iowans are committing war crimes. We are also failing to uphold basic human rights, killing without due process. As a result of Iowa's silence, this unjustified and inhumane drone warfare turns developing countries such as Iraq and Pakistan into literal open-air prisons terrorized by killer drones. Although the U.S. government claims to be assassinating bad guys in the name of the war on terror, reports from international press and human rights workers, as well as documents from our own government, show that many of the innocent lives have been taken, families and communities brutally disrupted. In addition to being morally wrong, these actions only fan the flames of terrorism targeting the United States. The U.S. war on terror cannot be won. Assassinations without due process and brutalization of innocents will never reduce terrorism. But we should be asking ourselves if this is not, in fact, by design. The U.S. post 9/11 now exists in a state of perpetual war where every person anywhere in the world can be declared an enemy combatant with absolutely no oversight by Congress or the American people. In the course of this war, weapons manufacturers and military contractors have made billions upon billions of dollars as U.S. taxpayers' expense. And what do we show for it? All right. If the U.S. government honestly intended to reduce terrorism to protect the American public and serve humanitarian interests abroad, it would show it via an unwavering commitment to diplomacy, democracy, and the rule of law, not an endless secret war that exists only to serve the elite economic and political class. The U.S. drone warfare is literally terrorism. I added the words drones kill, exposed the lie of respectability of drone warfare that this army billboard is promoting. As a political artist and a believer in free speech, this act of truth speaking and exposing lies is far more valuable than the cost of any sign. Finally, I hope this piece of political speech will serve to enlighten my fellow Iowan Christians to wake up to this terrible drone warfare that we are part of, and about which the majority of us have no clue. I wish to remain anonymous, to be free to continue this important work. So that's you would think that some press would go by and drive and look at this sign and see indeed that it is altered. But 4 days out there in the ethers and we haven't got a bite. Huh. I don't know what to say, except that, boy, if that doesn't prove the whole issue that we're trying to raise, we can't get anybody to discuss this issue in Des Moines. They run away from it. Nobody wants to talk about the Drone Command Center. And people who were leaning on the moral leadership are just hiding. We're trying to make an effort to reach regular pastors and ministers to try to get more and more to publicly speak out. So that's kind of the work I'm doing. We've got other things, of course, going on.
I'll tell you, I'm surprised they didn't paint over that sign in a few hours after it was changed.
Well, it's a lazy city out here. I don't know what to tell you. Well, yeah. We'll monitor the sign. I'm sure they'll respond to it eventually. Yes. But we're the other stuff is we've got about four new young people going to be here this summer, trying it out. We're doing what we call a summer internship with these folks. So that will be going on. We'll just kind of persevere with the drone command center campaign. Our next big thing will be in August, but in between then and now, who knows? This political artist may strike again. We may get something going on this very important issue of political speech, is what it is. That's how I look at it. Versus destruction of property bought by money and lies. Wow. What's the most valuable? And the a political artist does things like this to put themselves at risk to make it a valued thing, because the billboards are all bought by people with money. This ain't free speech. This is all money speech, and the corporate military industrial complex has a lot of money, and they got a lot of our free speech. But to take it back, artists have to introspect themselves in a way that they're confronting and exposing the lie in an artistic way on the same canvas, so to speak, that the lie is placed. And the canvas is judged as truth or property. And the government will see it as property, and we'll speak of it as an issue of truth. So that's the outlines of the argument. But first, sign down, and no one at the moment is interested. So, we'll see what happens. I think this is could be a very interesting little thing we do, or whoever the guy is or gal is. That puts us in the loop.
Could be very interesting.
Yes. So stay tuned. Jess and Ruby, I had no word from Ruby, but Jess was here a couple weeks ago, as I think I reported. And haven't heard from them, but that's okay. They're out figuring out what they want to do. The community, we're doing all right. It's just so hot. Gotta get used to the hot weather. We had no spring in Iowa. Just like a maybe 24-hour period. I don't know. Disappeared. We went from cold to hot.
Well, it's the weather or the climate is taking after the financial situation of the country. You have the haves and the have-nots, and nobody in the middle anymore. We got hot and cold. We don't have any spring or fall anymore.
Extreme weather is what we got. Yeah. All right. Charles, thank you for calling. I hope this gets me back online.
Okay. It sure will. Thank you, Frank. We appreciate having you. We sure missed you last week, but we're glad to have you back this time.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.
And now, cue the Rimsky-Korsakov, please. And now for another episode of Professor Rutherford P. Roswell's Conspiracy Corner. We find Professor Rutherford P. Roswell sitting at home, getting ready to begin his weekly podcast from his basement, imitation cedar panel man cave. He has his computer and his headset and professional-looking microphone with the fireplace glowing in front of him and his English setter, Apollo, lying on the carpeted floor, feet straight in the air, sound asleep. Professor Roswell checks the time on the computer, sips his drowsy time tea, swivels in his chair and draws the Crown Royal single malt from the glass case, turns back, sprinkles a dash into the tea and sets the bottle on the floor near his feet. All around on the walls hang dusty photos of Roswell and the important people he has interviewed over the decades. He receives an email notification from the network telling him the show will start soon. He smiles as he types salutations to the many listeners now showing up in the chat room from around the world. Skagway, hello, Roslyn, hi there. Sleep Mute, Sicily, Mayberry, Virginia City, College Station, Beverly Hills, Barstow, Columbia Heights, Foggy Bottom, Rocky Top, Bear Creek, Sandy Holler, Alsace, Genoa, Venice, Vicksburg. Hello, hello. Welcome, hello. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And now with your host, Professor Rutherford P. Roswell, it's time again for Conspiracy Corner, sponsored by Drowsy Time Tea, because sometimes it's the best you can do. It's all you can do. You did your best. Just hold some hot tea in your tired hands close to your chest and slowly fall asleep. Sleep, sleep. Maybe put the hot cup on the desk. Sleep, sleep. Drowsy Time Tea. Forget about it and sleep.
You. Stop whatever it is you're doing, because it really doesn't matter. As long as the persistent lie about the JFK, RFK, and MLK murders persists in this country, nothing you do, working out, going to work, eating, sleeping, talking, none of it matters. It really doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. None of it matters. You do not matter. Hello, 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 welcome to all. I'm so glad you're here. Let's get right to it, shall we? It's true. It's all true, the conspiracy theories. I have to sit back, even me, try to comprehend what that means, even after all these years. Anyone who believes in the latest fairy tale, Santa Fe, must also believe in Rudolph, Mrs. Santa, and the elves. It's all fake, a big hoax. Such a gigantic lie, this life. I really don't think I can put my head around it, even yet, as they say, I'm trying. It means, wow, words really can't describe it. I can tell you that your newspapers are controlled. Your television news, but those are just words. It's different. Much, much different to stop and actually realize what that is. I can tell you your government is more like a mafia organization than a government, but well, I think we'd all be better served by silence than by another heaping helping of information tonight.
Find some comfort at Willow's World. A variety of news, commentary, and poetry at Willow's Poetry Corner, where there are comfy cushions and a tempting selection of delectable comestibles. A show that's quirkily and quintessentially British, with a unique twist featuring Willow Andreasen, your host. Join Willow, Monday, 6 to 8 p.m. EST, Studio B.
Travels to Earth through the rainbow crystal bubbles from the furthest reaches of space and time, across the dimensions, through the elements, and in harmony with the colors of the universe. Through her mastery of abstract stream of consciousness malapropisms, she weaves a web of comic, satiric, cosmic conversation. Her subjects can range from Norman, the goose next door, to astrology and earth changes, and into the deep recesses of the soul matrix. She holds a wealth of knowledge on herbs, plants, and astrology. Join Mona and her guests on Adventures of a Feral Hippie as she touches the earthly radio waves 5 days a week at 2 p.m. Monday to Friday on Studio B at Revolution Radio.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Our next guest of the evening, a weekly columnist, is all over the internet. Op-ed News, World News Trust, Information Clearinghouse, probably a half a dozen other places, and his own radio show. And here we are with Philip Ferrugio, and it's the Empire, stupid.
Okay, good evening, Working Stiffs. Since it was Memorial Day this past week, let's do the Pawns of War. P-A-W-N-S, Pawns of War. She would always have the brightest smile as she stood at the intersection of Avenue T and Ocean Avenue in Brooklyn, New York, circa 1968. She was our crossing guard, and we all loved Mrs. Lombardo. Each morning and afternoon during school days, she would greet each and every kid who passed by her post. On Sundays, before and after each Catholic Mass at St. Edmund's Church, she would be there, again with that contagious smile. The young kids loved her as one would love a favorite aunt, and the seniors, who seemed to make up a majority at each Sunday Mass, enjoyed the special care Mrs. Lombardo offered them. Then, perhaps sometime in 1968, her son Tommy joined the Marines, along with his childhood buddy Pete Harrows of the Harrows Coffee Shop on Avenue U. A year later, Pete returned to the coffee shop from his tour of duty in Vietnam unscathed. Tommy returned in a box. Mrs. Lombardo still took up her post on that corner, but the sparkling smile was replaced by what this writer remembers as a Mona Lisa smile or half frown. As with the lady in the famous portrait, Mrs. Lombardo had too much to say without saying a thing. Memorial Day is beyond us once again, and it seems the dogs of war are at it always. 50-plus years ago, there were 58,220 Tommy Lombardos who would never see the smiles of their mom's faces ever again. Factor that within approximately 2 million Vietnamese who lost their lives, and one can deduce what our empire's imperial presence meant. For what? For whom? Yet each and every year, spanning those decades, our empire's handlers and their compliant, embedded media sell us this fake and false bill of goods. They honor those dead as, quote, fallen heroes, when they really should be apologizing for using them as pawns in this geopolitical game they play. Fast forward to 2002 and go up until the present and see how this scam continues. Phony wars following the dictates of what Zbigniew Brzezinski labeled the grand chessboard for the key Eurasian region were in play then and now. What George Bush Sr. made famous as the New World Order has our empire as the only one needed to assure the safety of humanity. And I have this great bridge in Brooklyn for sale. Imagine the gall of the movers and shakers of this military-industrial empire to keep playing that fear card on a mostly subservient and apathetic populace. It worked during the Red Scare, 1950s and 60s, with a Cold War that was most predicated on continuous fake news. Eisenhower, through his handlers, the two Dulles brothers, knew that the Russians were much weaker than us militarily. The Russians knew it as well. Check out the great 1980 Andrew Davis film, The Package, to see how these scams work. They will lower the flag that this empire has hijacked from us, every Memorial Day. They will have somber ceremonies to honor the dead fallen heroes. What they should always have done is honor those dead U.S. servicemen and women by acknowledging the criminal acts of sending them to those hornet's nests overseas to kill and be killed, or to be maimed for life with lost limbs, lost eyes, fatal diseases from Agent Orange and depleted uranium. After that is all done, to give just a teaspoon of comfort to the dead and their families, these war criminals who are still breathing among us should be tried and convicted for high treason. Let justice be done, though the heavens may fall. Thank you.
And now for another episode of The Adventures of Orson B. Riddle, crisis actor of Paducah. Inside his little house, on the walls, above the TV and Xbox in a brown frame, is his membership certificate to the Crisis Actors Guild, and on the kitchen table, he still has to mail it yet, is his membership application to the Propaganda Movie Actors Association. His suitcase lays wide open on the bed because he just got home from Florida and you can't really see the stickers he's collected from Oklahoma, Texas, California, New York, Boston, Connecticut, Nevada. Orson B. Riddle usually only gets 1, 2, or maybe 3 days at home until it's time to pack up his makeup kit, head bandages, prosthetics, and go to the next big event. For 3 years, he worked at Walmart, and then he saw this ad on Craigslist, and he's never looked back.
It's a nice day. Orson's sitting in a tree in his backyard, listening to music on his headphone, eating graham crackers. He's been reading stuff on the internet, even though he's really not supposed to. Just supposed to watch the TV at close to full volume all day long and wait for the telephone. That's when he decided he wasn't ready. Climbed a tree with the almost full box of graham crackers and his music. He's thinking about giving it up. Quitting. Throwing in the towel, even though that would mean losing his free Cocoa Puffs for life, his timeshare in West Texas, his RV camping spot in Times Square, his 401k, and his PlayStation 3. He's been thinking of starting a new career. Maybe crisis acting isn't all there is. Orson B. Riddle had been thinking maybe he would like to be an astronaut. One thing he still might do, though, he thought as he chewed contemplatively on his graham cracker, wiping crumbs off his chest, is to still go ahead and attend the annual Crisis Actors Convention being held next month in Las Vegas. And then, well, maybe one more big event, just maybe. They, his bosses in the Ford Torino, say if he fills out his Crisis Actor punch card, he can get a free set of stainless steel pots and pans from Walmart. Orson's only one punch shy of a full card. He really likes some stainless steel pots and pans. Orson began climbing down, then into a dead sprint, running across the street to chase the empty graham cracker box that was getting away, and he wasn't sure if it was really completely empty. There were lots of people in the park. Probably Orson B. Riddle just couldn't help himself. He stumbled, so it seemed, tumbled in the grass, grabbed his leg, now both legs, rolled on his back and grimaced like a European soccer player. People rushed to him. Some began to cry. Several took selfies with Orson in the background. Then the sound of many ambulances could be heard in the distance coming closer. Orson popped the fake blood packet he always carried in his sock, rubbed it on his face, legs, and arms, and before anyone knew it, his head was rolled in a bandage. Orson's leg was cut off at the knee and he'd stopped breathing. He was hurried into the first ambulance while six others waited behind, lights flashing. Orson peeked out from behind his closed eye and could not believe his luck. It was just like in the one movie with the giant dog that slobbers on the lost baseball and that one kid who fakes drowning so he can kiss the lifeguard. Right then, life began to imitate art as the beautiful long-haired paramedic in short shorts in slow motion ties her long black hair into a ponytail, leans over, puts her luscious mouth around his to save his life. And Orson thinks, just like St. Paul on the road to Damascus, "Here I am, Lord. This is who I am. I'm never changing. I'm meant to be a crisis actor, and a crisis actor is what I shall remain. Alleluia."
Join us next week for yet another episode of Orson B. Riddle, Crisis Actor of Paducah, sponsored by Quick Dry Oats. Hardens to a cement block in your stomach within minutes, because you never know when you're going to get a good hard kick in the gut. We're there for you on the job, on the weekend, even when you sleep, because these days you really never know when the big hit is going to come. Now do you? We're Quick Dry Oats of Northeast Minneapolis.
Our next guest of the evening is Rosanna Frechette from Denver, and Michael Annis, our regular columnist on our fourth Thursdays, is going to introduce Rosanna, and right about now.
Hello?
Hello, Michael. It's Chuck, the New American Dream Radio Show.
Hi, Chuck. Hey, it's my great pleasure to reintroduce my good friend and colleague, Rosanna Frechette. I say reintroduce because we were on the New American Dream before together. Anyway, Rosanna is a fantastic performance artist who is often my collaborator. She's a poet, and as you will see today, she's a dedicated political and social activist. She heads up an organization in Denver, DARCO, which she will talk about now and its relevance to artists and homelessness and maybe other things. So this is Rosanna.
All right. Hello. And thank you so much for having me on the show today. It's an honor to be here. I founded Denver Artists for Rent Control in May of 2016 to address the immediate crisis for attainable space, which we now understand is a national crisis of vast proportions, especially the housing crisis, which is tragic as well as vast and immediate. So the range of related issues that we have uncovered and been exploring over the last few years includes rent control, but also gentrification, zoning choices, renters' rights, homelessness, and the right to rest, all of which DARCO has been actively involved with other allied organizations. We are a humanitarian group concerned with a legacy of arts and culture that is greatly at risk, along with all other aspects of our population, as rents escalate and space for everything from housing to creative workspace, practice space, venues to perform in, venues to gather and philosophize in, and even parking spots have become ridiculously out of reach. So I decided a few years ago that rather than fall into a little hole of despair over this, I would do what popped into my brain one day. I just had this very crystal awareness that said, when worried individual concern becomes confident community action, an entire energy field can change. And so I decided to activate, take action, and look for solutions rather than fall into depression over a massive problem. One of the actions that Denver Artists for Rent Control has taken is to organize a letter writing campaign wherein we invited our public to step forward and express themselves to both our mayor of Denver and our governor of Colorado. And in discussing the show today, Michael was suggesting that I might share a consolidated version of the letter that I wrote to the mayor and governor. And I'm going to share that now, and then I'll talk a little bit more about that. This was written on November 15, 2017. Dear Mayor Hancock and Governor Hickenlooper, I address the two of you same time over what a good many of your citizens hold dear, the need for community of arts and culture to hold ground in our town and state, and the very humanitarian responsibility regarding a human right to attainable space in which to live, work, create, express, and gather. I believe that without these five things, no culture of any kind can thrive. Our entire region is well known worldwide for having natural beauty and depth of character, both of which are at great risk over what I have come to call irresponsible, uncontrolled growth and outrageously escalating rents. You know what I am speaking of, I'm sure, and we can say that for one, rents are soaring out of sight as a direct result of the Colorado statute banning rent control by municipalities for housing. I firmly believe that statute can and should be repealed. I am fully aware of how it first came into being and why it is still there over 30 years later. To allow municipalities to have control over rent escalations would be progressive, logical, and fair. It seems almost always to have been characteristic of Denver and Colorado to be these things, but not always, and sadly, not now. Let's repeal that statute in order that rents may not escalate drastically overnight. I understand legislative process takes time, and I am counting on you to favor this change in every way possible when the time comes. Although I applaud all efforts to help an unacceptable situation regarding affordable housing to turn around, we are far from acceptable in terms of solutions to our immediate housing crisis. It is my fervent hope that as our leaders of this most well-known city of Denver and this most desired to live in state of Colorado, you will do what is right for the people that have been here through decades, bringing character, quality, service, loyalty, and substance to these places which you were elected to uphold the integrity of. I moved to Denver in 1976 and have led a creative life from which I have given in spades to my community. I am a spoken word multimedia performance artist that strives to make engaging art relevant to societal concerns and what it is to be human in real time, including the beauty of living in the abundant creative energy of Denver and Colorado. I have worked artistically for minimal pay with all populations of our town, including citywide youth. The work of so many artists such as myself has fed countless Denver and Colorado citizens and visitors much inspiration and venue dollars, along with added incentive to be here as opposed to any place else. There are a good many artists in this state that are so passionate about the drive to feed not only themselves, but the society they live here within, that they contribute exceptional art, which often draws people from around the world as well as from the area we live in. No city, not Paris, London, New York, LA, or Denver, is going to be nearly the city it is without its arts and culture. Mayor Hancock and Governor Hickenlooper, please do everything you can to take care of the people. I ask that you please remember your own roots here to address the outrageously unbalanced change that has taken place in our town and state, where an alarming percentage of the basic population that is the character of the place is so suddenly, seemingly undervalued and abruptly, harshly displaced. We will hope for a spike in decency of leadership that favors the character, community, culture, and spirit of Denver and surrounding towns, as well as the state of Colorado, for the love of humanity. So that's the letter that I wrote, but I also collected, we collected citywide and metro-wide, a good little number of letters that were written by a cross-section of people, concerned citizens, for what's been going on in our town when we noticed about 2 years ago now a massive boom of new development. And much of it is being driven by the luxury housing segment of development. It's not really for the people who live here. It is causing displacement. It is causing homelessness. It has caused me to deliver these letters to the mayor and the governor. And I have to say I was a little surprised, not totally surprised, but a little surprised that they have not responded. These letters were delivered in November, and I have not heard anything from either the mayor or the governor. But I have developed a new resolve to understand that we must help shape a new administration across the board, nationwide, at all levels, to take care of humanity. And so DARCA's latest action is one where we are gathering humanitarian candidates to introduce our community at the Mercury Cafe on June 3rd, Sunday afternoon. It's a good old-fashioned Sunday social. And we have done the work to actually research those who are running for offices here, both at state election this year and then for city next year, and to understand who is standing for the people and the values of having community that is sustainable as culture and community that belongs. So we've got this coming up, and it just brings up to my mind, you know, at first I was saying, well, you know, humanitarian candidates for a progressive new administration. And then, oh my gosh, I had this lightning bulb understanding just about a week ago in all this planning that what we are really asking for is a humanitarian administration. That's what it's going to take. So that's one of our actions, but we also have been taking action for the last few years to work with the homeless population. Denver has an urban camping ban. We do homeless sweeps that are ruthless. We have been trying to change that by changing it at a state level so all the cities in our state can be together in this. There's a lot of resistance at state Congress for a lot of reasons. All of this, by the way, is very complicated, of course, very complicated range of issues, and it's why a lot of people get frustrated and just throw their hands up. But I have to say that there is definitely a domino effect and that it's up to us to turn the tide. We definitely want to listen to our homeless population when they say things like, it's happening in almost every large metropolitan city. First the housing goes up, then more folks wind up out on the street, and then there are high emotions about the problems we have caused. Housing meaning luxury housing, okay? Addressed at the United Nations in February 2017 when Leilani Faraha said the boom in luxury real estate is fueling the housing crisis and ripping communities apart. We have sister cities fighting in the United States on this very same stuff. That rent control statute exists in many states. Lots of people are going up to bat at both city and state levels for all of this. And my hat goes off to everyone on this front that is standing up and taking action. So then in closing right now, I would just like to say, our sleeves are rolled up to do the work it takes for the long haul for humanity. And you can visit DenverArtistsForRentControl.org, but also visit home.one. Those are a couple of sites that have really got some good research. Do your research, be informed, show up, and take action. And thank you for listening.
Well, thank you, Rosanna. That was a very informed and informative presentation. I don't quite understand the rent control statute thing. Could you explain that a little bit better, but very quickly, because we're almost out of time?
Yes, we have a statute in the state of Colorado that bans rent control being set by municipalities for housing. And that was put into place in 1981. And my understanding through my research is that there were such strong tenant unions back in the 60s and 70s, and predominantly in Boulder is where that came from for Colorado. There were developers who wanted to go like gangbusters, like they do, you know, and we can thank developers for a lot, but some of it, not so much in the favor of the people. Of course, we know that there's luxury developments that are kicking people out of the ballpark. So the developers didn't want to be so controlled by the population that was standing up for tenant rights. And they snuck through, this is my understanding, they snuck through a statute through Congress that nobody really saw that happening. And then once it was in place, it's just been really hard to remove it, including the year 2000 in Telluride, the city wanted developers to have a portion of something they were doing to be affordable for their city, and it was taken to task, and our Supreme Court in Colorado ruled that that was going against that statute. Now, that statute exists in other states, too. There are lots of them, and mirror things are going on in Illinois, Oregon, Washington, as well as Colorado and Denver right now that have to do with this prohibitive statute. But let's know that this does not mean fixed rent. When I talk about rent control, I'm not talking about fixed rent. I'm talking about having municipalities have a right to make decisions about putting a reasonable cap on how much rents can go up in any period of time. Okay. So, and if they don't want to have a cap, they could say so. It could be up to the cities themselves.
All right. Well, thank you. I hadn't quite gotten through my head was that it was a ban on rent control. And so I was all topsy-turvy on this. And thank you.
Yeah. That's the thing is that the cities themselves and states that have a statewide ban like that, the cities themselves cannot make decisions about caps on how much rent can go up, what percentage can go up. So sometimes it goes up like really ridiculously overnight, 50%, 100%, that's when people are becoming homeless overnight. That's happening. And if we had more time, I could share a whole lot more information with you on that. But that's why I called out just a few websites for you. And just for the listening people to know that at a national crisis, this is by Home.One, this is what's been called the silent crisis in America. And they have done their research to recall for us that the housing crisis was not once mentioned in the last presidential debates, even though it is a number one most immediate survival need going on that isn't being met right now. So this is not okay.
No, it's not okay, but...
You're welcome.
Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
It is no secret that the so-called mainstream media is best described as controlled propaganda. Countless news stories are either totally ignored or spun with half-truths, and because of this, essential facts and vital information are often compromised. Join Dr. Ott every Friday night on Studio B at 10 p.m. Eastern and learn why The Story Behind the Story was nominated for a Peabody Award in its second year of producing unparalleled broadcasting excellence in 1997. That is, if you really care about learning the truth.
Wadia will remain a dictatorship. Or be quiet. Why are you guys so anti-dictators? Imagine if America was a dictatorship. You could let 1% of the people have all the nation's wealth. You could help your rich friends get richer by cutting their taxes and bailing them out when they gamble and lose. You could ignore the needs of the poor for healthcare and education. Your media would appear free, but would secretly be controlled by one person and his family. You could wiretap phones. You could torture foreign prisoners. You could have rigged elections. You could lie about why you go to war. You could fill your prisons with one particular racial group, and no one would complain. You could use the media to scare the people into supporting policies that are against their interests.
Tune in Monday through Friday, 4 p.m. Eastern Time, for Liberation Nation with Deacon John, where America comes to hear the truth.
I know this is hard for you Americans to imagine, but please try.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Our next guest of the show is Michael Annis. Michael Annis is the executive editor of Howling Dog Press. He is also in Denver. Michael's a poet and an activist, and we're going to hear from Michael Annis in Denver, Colorado, right now.
Hi, Chuck. Hi, Mike. Tonight, I'll once again read from John Dos Passos' 1919, book number 2 from the USA Trilogy, a chapter titled Playboy, about American journalist, activist, and poet John Reed. My opinion is every school kid in the United States should be required to read Dos Passos, not only for the literary excellence, but moreover the immense historical knowledge that bleeds throughout his work. So here goes, Playboy, John Dos Passos, about John Reed. Jack Reed was the son of a United States Marshal, a prominent citizen of Portland, Oregon. He was a likely boy, so his folks sent him east to school and to Harvard. Harvard stood for the broad A in those contacts so useful in later life and good English prose. If a hedgehog can't be cultured at Harvard, the hedgehog can't at all. And the Lowells only speak to the Cabots and the Cabots and the Oxford Book of Verse. Reed was a likely youngster. He wasn't a Jew or a socialist, and he didn't come from Roxbury. He was husky greedy, had appetite for everything. A man's got to like many things in his life. Reed was a man. He liked men. He liked women. He liked eating and riding and foggy nights and drinking and foggy nights and swimming and football and rhymed verse and being cheerleader, Ivy orator, making clubs, not the very best clubs. His blood didn't run thin enough for the very best clubs. And Copy's voice reading The Man Who Would Be King, The Dying Fall, Urn Burial, good English prose, the lamps coming on across the yard under the elms in the twilight. Dim voices in the lecture halls, the dying fall, the elms, the discobulus, the bricks of the old buildings and the commemorative gates and the goodies and the deans and the instructors all crying in thin voices, refrain, refrain. The rusty machinery creaked, the deans quivered under their mortarboards, the cogs turned to class day, and Reed was out in the world. Washington Square, conventional, turns out to be a cuss word. Vion seeking a lodging for the night in the Italian tenements on Sullivan Street, Bleecker, Carmine. Research proves RLS to have been a great coxman. And as for the Elizabethans, to hell with them. Ship on a cattle boat and see the world, have adventures you can tell, funny stories about every evening. Man's got to love the quickening pulse, the feel that today in foggy evenings, footsteps, taxicabs, women's eyes, many good things in his life. Europe with a dash of horseradish, gulp Paris like an oyster, but there's more to it than the Oxford Book of English Verse. Link Steffens talked the cooperative commonwealth, revolution in a voice as mellow as Copy's, Diogenes Steffens with Marx for a lantern going through the West looking for a good man. Socrates Steffens kept asking, why not revolution? Jack Reed wanted to live in a tub and write verses. But he kept meeting bums, working men, husky guys he liked out of luck, out of work. Why not revolution? He couldn't keep his mind on his work with so many people out of luck. In school, hadn't he learned the Declaration of Independence by heart? Reed was a Westerner, and words meant what they said. When he said something standing with a classmate at the Harvard Club bar, he meant what he said from the soles of his feet to the waves of his untidy hair. His blood didn't run thin enough for the Harvard Club and the Dutch Treat Club and respectable New York freelance bohemia. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, not much of that round the silk mills. When, in 1913, he went over to Patterson to write up the strike, textile workers parading, beaten up by the cops, the strikers in jail. Before he knew it, he was a striker parading, beaten up by the cops in jail. He wouldn't let the editor bail him out. He'd learn more with the strikers in jail. He learned enough to put on the pageant of the Patterson strike in Madison Square Garden. He learned the hope of a new society where nobody would be out of luck. Why not revolution? The Metropolitan Magazine sent him to Mexico to write up Pancho Villa. Pancho Villa taught him to write, and the skeleton mountains and the tall Oregon cactus and the armored trains and the bands playing in little plazas full of dark girls in blue scarves, and the bloody dust and the ping of rifle shots in the enormous night of the desert, and the brown, quiet-voiced peons dying, starving, killing for liberty, for land, for water, for schools. Mexico taught him to write. Reed was a Westerner, and words meant what they said. The war was a blast that blew out all the Diogenes lanterns. The good man began to gang up, to call for machine guns. Jack Reed was the last of the great race of war correspondents who ducked under censorship and risked their skins for a story. Jack Reed was the best American writer of his time. If anybody had wanted to know about the war, they could have read about it in the articles he wrote about the German front, the Serbian retreat, Saloniki, behind the lines in the tottering empire of the Tsar, dodging the secret police, jail and Chalm. The brass hats wouldn't let him go to France because they said one night in the German trenches, kidding with the Boche gun crew, he'd pull the string on a Hun gun pointed at the heart of France. Playboy stuff, but after all, what did it matter who fired the guns or which way they were pointed? Reed was with the boys who were being blown to hell, with the Germans, the French, the Russians, the Bulgarians, the seven little tailors in the ghetto of Salonika. And in 1917, he was with the soldiers and peasants in Petrograd in October, Smolny, 10 days that shook the world. No more Via Picturesque Mexico, no more Harvard Club Playboy stuff, plans for Greek theaters, rhyming verse, good stories, and an old-time war correspondent. This wasn't fun anymore. This was grim, delicate. Back in the United States, indictments, the Masses trial, the Wobbly trial, Wilson cramming the jails, forged passports, speeches, secret documents, riding the rods across the cordon sanitaire, hiding in the bunkers on steamboats, jail in Finland, all his papers stolen. No more chance to write verses now. No more warm chats with every guy you met up with. The college boy with a nice smile talking himself out of trouble with the judge. At the Harvard Club, they're all in the intelligence service making the world safe for the Morgan-Baker-Stillman combination of banks. That old tramp sipping his coffee out of a tomato can's a spy for the general staff. The world's no fun anymore. Only machine gun fire and arson, starvation, lice, bedbugs, cholera, typhus. No lint for bandages, no chloroform or ether. Thousands dead of gangrened wounds, cordons sanitaire, and everywhere spies. The windows of Smolny glow white hot like a Bessemer. No sleep in Smolny. Smolny, the giant rolling mill running 24 hours a day, rolling out men, nations, hopes, millenniums, impulses, fears, raw material for the foundations of a new society. A man has to do many things in his life. Reed was a Westerner. Words meant what they said. He threw everything he had in himself into Smolny, dictatorship of the proletariat, USSR, the first workers' republic was established and stands. Reed wrote, undertook missions. There were spies everywhere. Worked till he dropped, caught typhus, and died in Moscow. So, I found this beautiful piece by John Reed titled Whose War? It was published in The Masses, April 1917. Reed begins with the quote, "The current ebullition of patriotism is wonderful, Reverend Dr. Parkhurst." John Reed. By the time this goes to press, the United States may be at war. The day the German note arrived, Wall Street flung the American flag to the breeze. The brokers on the floor of the stock exchange sang the Star Spangled Banner with tears rolling down their cheeks, and the stock market went up. In the theaters, they are singing patriotic ballads of the George M. Cohan Irving Berlin variety, playing the national anthem and flashing the flag in the portrait of long-suffering Lincoln, while the tired suburbanite who has just been scalped by a ticket speculator goes into hysterics. Exclusive ladies whose husbands own banks are rolling bandages for the wounded, just like they do in Europe. A $1 million fund for ICE and field hospitals has started, and the Boston budget for conveying virgins inland has grown enormously. The directors of the British, French, and Belgian Permanent Blind Relief Fund have added American to the name of the organization in gruesome anticipation. Our soldier boys guarding the aqueducts and bridges are shooting each other by mistake for Teutonic spies. There is talk of conscription, war brides, and on to Berlin. I know what war means. I have been with the armies of all the belligerents except one, and I have seen men die and go mad and lie in hospitals suffering hell. But there is a worse thing than that. War means an ugly mob madness, crucifying the truth tellers, choking the artists, sidetracking reforms, revolutions, and the working of social forces. Already in America, those citizens who oppose the entrance of their country into the European melee are called traitors, and those who protest against the curtailing of our meager rights of free speech are spoken of as dangerous lunatics. We have had a forecast of the censorship when the naval authorities in charge of the Seville wireless cut off American news from Germany, and only the wildest fictions reached Berlin via London, creating a perilous situation. The press is howling for war. The church is howling for war. Lawyers, politicians, stockbrokers, social leaders are all howling for war. Theodore Roosevelt is again recruiting his thrice-thwarted family regiment. But whether it comes to actual hostilities or not, some damage has been done. The militarists have proved their point. I know of at least two valuable social movements that have suspended functioning because no one cares. For many years, this country is going to be a worse place for free men to live in. Less tolerant, less hospitable. Maybe it is too late, but I want to put down what I think about it all. Whose war is this? Not mine. I know that hundreds of thousands of American working men employed by our great financial patriots are not paid a living wage. I have seen poor men sent to jail for long terms without trial and even without any charge. Peaceful strikers and their wives and children have been shot to death, burned to death by private detectives and militiamen. The rich have steadily become richer and the cost of living higher and the workers proportionally poorer. These toilers don't want war, not even civil war, but the speculators, the employers, the plutocracy, they want it, just as they did in Germany and in England. And with lies and sophistries, they will whip up our blood until we are savage, and then we'll fight and die for them. I am one of a vast number of ordinary people who read the daily papers and occasionally the New Republic and want to be fair. We don't know much about international politics, but we want our country to keep off the necks of little nations, to refuse to back up American beasts of prey who invest abroad and get their fingers burned, and to stay out of quarrels not our own. We've got an idea that international law is the crystallized common sense of nations distilled from their experiences with each other, and that it holds good for all of them and can be understood by anybody. We are simple folk. Prussian militarism seemed to us insufferable. We thought the invasion of Belgium a crime. German atrocities horrified us, and also the idea of German submarines exploding ships full of peaceful people without warning. But then we began to hear about England and France jailing, fining, exiling, and even shooting men who refused to go out and kill. The Allied armies invaded and seized a part of neutral Greece, and a French admiral forced upon her an ultimatum as shameful as Austria's to Serbia. Russian atrocities were shown to be more dreadful than German, and hidden mines sown by England in the open sea exploded ships full of peaceful people without warning. Other things disturbed us. For instance, why was it a violation of international law for the Germans to establish a war zone around the British Isles, yet perfectly legal for England to close the North Sea? Why is it we submitted to the British order forbidding the shipment of non-contraband to Germany and insisted upon our right to ship contraband to the Allies? If our national honor was smirched by Germany's refusal to allow war materials to be shipped to the Allies, what happened to our national honor when England refused to let us ship non-contraband food and even Red Cross hospital supplies to Germany? Why is England allowed to attempt the avowed starvation of German civilians in violation of international law when the Germans cannot attempt the same thing without our horrified protest? How is it that the British can arbitrarily regulate our commerce with neutral nations while we raise a howl whenever the Germans, in quote, threaten to restrict our merchant ships going about their business, end quote? Why does our government insist that Americans should not be molested while traveling on Allied ships armed against the submarines? We have shipped and are shipping vast quantities of war materials to the Allies. We have floated the Allied loans. We have been strictly neutral toward the Teutonic powers only. Hence, the inevitable desperation of the last German note. Hence, this war we are on the brink of. Those of us who voted for Woodrow Wilson did so because we felt his mind and his eyes were open, because he had kept us out of the mad dogfight of Europe, and because the plutocracy opposed him. We had learned enough about the war to lose some of our illusions, and we wanted to be neutral. We grant that the president, considering the position he'd got himself into, couldn't do anything else but answer the German note as he did. But if we had been neutral, that note wouldn't have been sent. The president didn't ask us. He won't ask us if we want war or not. The fault is not ours. It is not our war. So I have an end note here. Jack Reed was one of only three Americans buried in the Russian Kremlin, the other two being Big Bill Haywood of the IWW Wobblies and Charles Ruthenberg, founder of the Communist Party, USA. However, Reed's old friend and comrade, Benjamin Gitlow, claimed that Reed had begun to shun the bureaucracy and violence of Soviet communism late in his life and have thus sought to posthumously enlist Reed in their own anti-communist cause. Reed has also been an influence upon the cinema. Soviet director Sergei Eisenstein's influential 1927 silent film, October, 10 Days That Shook the World, was based on Reed's book. Then half a century after Dos Passos published 1919, Warren Beatty made the 1981 film Reds, based on Reed's life.
And now, for another episode of The Adventures of Deputy and Candidate for Sheriff of Pecan County, Buddy Q. Twinkle. Buddy is patrolling the War on Terror Memorial Highway in South Central Alabama. He's sitting in a grove of trees next to a rotting deer carcass, can't see a thing. But he can hear that the highway is packed from all the noise. He cranks the Bolshoi Ballet in his earbuds as he snacks on the boiled potatoes he brought for break time, and also sneaks a peek at the crayfish buckwheat blintzes he packed for his lunch. He's got his personal phone pressed to his ear, waiting for a call to St. Petersburg to go through, and the scanner is running, waiting for a message from the Kremlin.
Buddy walks again into the Walmart. He puts the triple XL gray and navy blue men's sweatpants in the medium and small bins. He then goes to the fishing aisle, switches the prices on the lures, making the trout flies cost $100 and the fishing poles cost $2.95. But he then nonchalantly goes to the electronics aisle area and slowly puts the AA batteries in the AAA battery spot. Then he walks right next door to the books, turns around all the books written by George Bush, Bill O'Reilly, and Colin Powell, and discreetly places copies of Dr. Zhivago to cover them. Buddy is a Russian spy. Stay tuned for next week's episode of The Adventures of Deputy and Candidate for Sheriff of Pecan County, Buddy Q. Twinkle. Sponsored by Lemon Fresh Borax, also sponsors of On Babushka Kalashnikov's Corner, The View from My Piroshki Cart. When your dogs tell you the Russians pooped in the hallway while you were at work, and the Democrats tell you, no, we didn't rig the elections against Bernie Sanders. We did not commit treason, dozens of felonies. We didn't conspire against the American people. Look, look over there, Russians! We're there for you, protecting the homeland. Lemon Fresh Borax in the fading yellow box. And now a message in a Boone's Farm bottle. Notes we have received from listeners by email, chat room, telephone, telegraph, and telepathy. From Roseanne Barr, we get this. The United States is incapable of producing any results other than destruction and further fragmentation across staggeringly large parts of the planet. How much money has gone to the U.S. war on terror, and what has been the impact of this expenditure? The best figure I've seen on this comes from the Watson Institute's Cost of War Project at Brown University. It's a staggering $5.6 trillion, including certain future costs to care for this country's war vets. President Trump himself, with his usual sense of accuracy, has inflated that number even more, regularly speaking, of $7 trillion being lost somewhere in our never-ending wars in the greater Middle East. One of these days, he's going to turn out to be right. As for the impact of such an expenditure in the regions where these wars continue to be fought, largely nonstop since they were launched just after September 11, 2001, well, would certainly include the spread of terror outfits across the Middle East, parts of Asia and Africa. The creation in a region previously autocratic but relatively calm of a striking range of failed or failing states. Major cities that have been turned into absolute rubble with no money in sight for serious reconstruction. Internally displaced people and waves of refugees at levels that now match the moment after World War II when significant parts of the planet were in ruins. And that's just to start down a list of the true cost of our wars. At home, in a far quieter way, the impact has been similar. Just imagine, for instance, what our American world would have been like if any significant part of the funds that went into our fruitless, still spreading, now nameless conflicts had been spent on America's crumbling infrastructure instead of on the rise of the national security state as the unofficial fourth branch of government. Part of the trouble assessing the impact here in the U.S. is that in this era of public demobilization in terms of our wars, people are encouraged not to think about them at all, and they've gotten remarkably little attention. So sorting out exactly how they've come home, other than completely obvious developments like the militarization of the police, the flying of surveillance drones in our airspace, and so on, is hard. What makes the U.S. pretension to empire different from previous empires? As a start, it's worth mentioning that Americans generally don't even think of ourselves as an empire. Yet, since the Soviet Union imploded in 1991, our politicians and pundits have proudly called this country the last or lone superpower, the world's most exceptional or indispensable nation. But an empire? Oh, no. That said, I think that two things have made us different, imperially speaking. First was the post-1991 sense of ourselves as the ultimate winner of a vast imperial contest, a kind of arms race of many that had gone on since European ships armed with cannon had first broken into the world in perhaps the 15th century and began to conquer much of it. That post-Soviet moment of triumphalism of what seemed to be the top dogs in Washington, like the ultimate win, a forever victory. There was indeed a sense that there had never been and never would be a power like us. That inflated sense of our imperial self was what sent the geopolitical dreamers of the George W. Bush administration off to, in essence, create a Pax Americana. First in the greater Middle East, then perhaps the world, in a fashion never before imagined. One that they were convinced would put the Roman and British imperial moments to shame. And we all know, with the invasion of Iraq, just where that ended up. In the years since they launched that ultimate imperial venture in a cloud of hubris, the most striking difference I can see with various previous empires is that never has a great power still in something close to its imperial prime proven quite so incapable of applying its military and political might in a way that would successfully advance its aims. It has instead found itself overmatched by underwhelming enemy forces and incapable of producing any results other than destruction and further fragmentation across staggeringly large parts of the planet. Finally, of course, there's climate change. That is, for the first time in the history of empires, the very well-being of the planet itself is at stake. The game has, so to speak, changed, even if relatively few here have noticed.
A message in a Boone's Farm bottle. Notes we have received from listeners by email, chat room, telephone, telegraph, and telepathy.
Well, I want to do something for you. I want to do something for you. I'll do anything in the world I can. I want to do something for you if I can. Well, you can't do nothing for me. You can't do nothing for me. I don't care whatever you say. You can't do nothing for me. Understand? Well, I'll buy you a strip of land. I'll buy you a strip of land. I'll buy you a strip of land. I want to do something for you if I can. Don't want no strip of land. Don't want no strip of land. I don't want nothing in the world you got. You can't do nothing for me. Understand? Well, I'll buy you a Chevrolet. I'll buy you a Chevrolet. I'll buy you a Chevrolet. I want to do something for you. Understand?
Find some comfort at Willow's World, a variety of news, commentary and poetry at Willow's Poetry Corner, where there are comfy cushions and a tempting selection of delectable comestibles. A show that's quirkily and quintessentially British, with a unique twist featuring Willow Andreasen, your host. Join Willow, Monday 6 to 8 p.m. EST, Studio B.
Bitcoin, Litecoin, MyCoin, YourCoin, Blockchain, baby. Mondays at 1600 hours Eastern Studio A.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
And now it's time for Revolution College, information for the revolution, offered Thursday nights in the basement of the abandoned Humanities Building. The U.S. military is seeking to be more lethal in all domains, including space, Defense Secretary James N. Mattis said yesterday. In a briefing with reporters in Colorado Springs, Colorado, Mattis said U.S. Northern Command will have to change to meet the challenges of the future to include space-related security challenges. As the threats to North America evolve, we'll have to evolve the command too, he said. It will continue to adapt from what it does, incorporating cyber defenses, outer space priorities, and of course the air-breathing threats that we'll have to stay alert to. Mattis said changes start with business reforms inside the Pentagon. He noted the Defense Department is currently not adopting best practices from industry. We want to make the military more lethal in outer space and cyberspace, at sea, on land, and in the air, Mattis said. The department, he added, also wants to strengthen relations with U.S. partners and allies. The department needs to examine the changing character of war to include issues like artificial intelligence, hypersonics, and outer space activities, according to Mattis. These have all got to be looked at because, as we say in the U.S. Department of Defense, our adversaries get a vote. Mattis traveled to Colorado for the U.S. Air Force Academy's graduation ceremony yesterday and the change of command today at NORTHCOM and the North American Aerospace Defense Command. NORTHCOM was established October 1, 2002 to provide command and control of Department of Defense, Homeland Defense efforts, and coordinate defense support of civil authorities. And now, what do actual United States citizens have to say about their brave commander, Mattis? As the threats to North America evolve, what threats? We want to make the military more lethal. More lethal than killing everyone and destroying everything? Is that even possible? The department needs to include issues like artificial intelligence, hypersonics, and outer space activities, according to Mattis.
Sorry. Highly intelligent folks have no interest in destroying the planet many times over. If you want competent people, first you're going to have to get a Defense Department chief who doesn't go around telling the world he enjoys killing people. What a crock. The only threats to the U.S. are the feeble attempts at terrorism perpetrated by the few daring souls who come from the countries we bombed into the Stone Age. Where they fall short, we're served up a never-ending parade of false flag events by our own intelligence agencies to remind us of how much we need them while they bleed us dry. We've managed to dumb down our populace so much from two generations of deliberate faulty education, there's no chance we will ever produce the wunderkind necessary to realize the techno-destructo renaissance they're contemplating. Keep dreaming your sick fantasies, Jimmy. The United States of America is a killing machine governed by psychopaths. Cares not whom it kills and cooling Americans, but not in my name, ever. Is this the beginning of a response to President Putin, revelations of new weapons? On the last occasion, which the military called the Sputnik crisis, they got all sorts of advantages in the race to catch up. I'm expecting research grants to arms manufacturers.
Under its prevailing economic system that the world is constantly presented to the American taxpayers as a threat to national security, it's the equivalent of telling children scary bedtime stories. We want to make the military more lethal in outer space. There's wants, then there's needs. Who's threatening us from outer space? U.S. to treat fairly, humanely, also the socialists of Central America, Caribbean islands, and islets, South America, and EU, or will socialists be deemed enemy combatants, thus assassinated, imprisoned, bombed, etc.? For there is nothing the three U.S. top and dictatorial classes fear more than the rise of socialism, social democracies, political and judicial equality, universal health care, education, peace, police protection, etc. The department, he added, also wants to strengthen relations with U.S. partners and allies. By threatening sanctions for not siding with U.S. against Russia and Iran, is this how we strengthen relations with our allies?
The air-breathing threats? The air-breathing threats? What the actual is he talking about? We want to strengthen our relationships with our allies, but need to make the military more lethal, I guess, just in case those allies don't do our bidding quickly enough or some such. We could, of course, seek to make more countries our friends, but there's no fun in that. as to our adversaries getting a vote. Who knows what that means either? I guess it's some kind of military politi-speak truism that basically means our enemies are always waiting for their chance and everyone is an enemy. And weaponizing space is just nuts. Didn't we just sign a pact at the UN agreeing that all space exploration must be to the benefit of all nations and for peaceful purposes? Why, yes. Yes, we did. Back in 1967, U.S. military is hoping that Americans are too dumb to remember, or they're bother looking it up, and they're probably right about that one. I went to the original transcript, and Mattis says a lot more than what is in this brief article, but nothing he said negates the thrust of this summary. The air-breathing threats thing, he said, is indeed the end of that remark, and does not explain any further at all, for instance. We are being led by nuts directing us to the edge of a cliff.
Americans, brothers and sisters, brace yourself for the worst to come. The entire USA will soon become like Gaza today. None of this has anything to do with defense, which is a meaningless term for Americans who seem to value only aggression and avoid any action to help the human beings on this earth, even in the USA itself. Trump has accelerated almost the entire world turning away against the U.S., at least the Trump regime and his Congress. To counter this anti-American trend, which was started by Trump anti-world policy, his mad dog calls for more lethality against the world. It appears 20,000 nuclear warheads, 400-ship Navy with 20 carrier strike groups, 4,000 fighter bombers, bomber transport Air Force, 200 subs, 2 million men armed with millions of tanks, artillery, and missiles are not enough. The American weapons of mass destruction is not enough. Mad Dog wants to weaponize cyberspace, outer space, inner space, robotic intelligence, because these two are enemies. I suggest Mad Dog better go to this Hawaii volcano and start to bomb it to extinction. It has caused some real damages doing its thing without Pentagon approval.
This pitiful excuse for a human being exemplifies the insane psychopathic mental illness that seemingly has infected the Pentagon and every member of the government. The only threat to the citizens of the USA are these madmen and the bloated military police state they have fabricated with the blood and treasure of this crumbling empire. Not a democracy nor a republic, but a corporate military fascist dictatorship. We Americans and the rest of the world are in serious danger because of these lunatics. U.S. military seeks to be more lethal, including in space, Mattis. Perhaps it might cut the time allowed for hijacked planes to wander around for over an hour as on 9/11. By the way, the Pentagon was struck at the same time that a Pentagon in the air was flying near it. That mysterious white plane? Though there are photos and videos of this military plane, a Boeing 747 painted totally white, known as the E-4B Doomsday plane, a substitute Pentagon, a state-of-the-art communications platform which can serve as an airborne command center for all U.S. military forces in a national world crisis. There it was, circling above the White House on 9/11, the Department of the Air Force officially denies there was any plane there on 9/11. A Pentagon in the air, an Air Force government plane the size of a 747 designed to keep the government running while airborne in light of a nuclear attack or any other potential dire national security problem. And this, of course, was left out by the 9/11 Commission in their final report. With video and photo evidence and CNN and others as witnesses, there's no disputing the fact that this plane was seen flying over the Pentagon and White House vicinity just as the attack on the Pentagon was occurring or had occurred within seconds, as the government had the foreknowledge to have an E-4B stationed over the D.C. restricted airspace at the time of the attack. Sort of suggests there was foreknowledge of 9/11. It has been suggested that the white plane was mission control for the 9/11 attack on our country.
Revolution College, Thursdays in the basement of the abandoned humanities building. And now we join In Progress, another episode of The Americans. The Americans is brought to us by Crisis Actors of the Homeland, Operation Mockingbird, Operation Northwoods, COINTELPRO, and by Kraft and Blackwater, bringing you Aurora, Tucson, Orlando, the Boston bombing, Sandy Hook, San Bernardino, Charlottesville, and so much more. The Americans dream of marshmallow clouds and lollipop lanes and TV towns, while the world wails, fists clenched, tears streaming. The Americans dream of rocket ships, fireworks, freedom, and alleluia, while they sleep on through the alarm, the house afire. It's true that the newcomers to Washington, D.C. are different than ever before, but after all is said and done, they are Americans. The construction is underway for the wall around the Washington, D.C. Beltway to drain the swamp with an impressive culvert system and to separate the White House, the FBI, the CIA, the Pentagon, the Congress, and the Washington Press Corps from normal human beings. Scattered around the job site are the wooden boards to be tacked up all around the new wall with the message. Let me put it this way. While 9/11 was a U.S. deep state operation, probably subcontracted for execution to the Israelis, the entire Washington swamp has been, since 9/11, accomplice after the fact by helping to maintain the cover-up. If this is brought into light, then thousands of political careers are going to crash and burn into the scandal.
The entire Nutt administration has been busy this week with organizing the annual summer picnic on the White House lawn, with the theme this year, dollar signs, tanks, and boobs. Buzz the Space Dog, Ricardo the Space Cat, Rusty the Patsy, Mama Pajama Jemima the MK Ultra Trainer, Jews the Limo Driver, Muhammad Ali the Terrorist, Spanky the House Alien, Skippy the Construction Worker, Self-Taught on YouTube Demolition Expert, The Child Left Behind, Morgan Freeman, Secretary of the War of the Worlds, Warren Beatty, the Secretary of Getting Things Right, and Ralph the Janitor, Secretary of Keeping Things Secret That Should Be Secret. All are working under the guidance of First Lady Imelda Nutt to get everything just right. From the dollar sign seven-layer cakes with the Republican showgirls popping out extravaganza in the Rose Garden, to the U.S. Army tanks and only tanks in random home search parade, to go down every street in Washington, D.C., and end up with the 1,000 tank lineup on Pennsylvania Avenue, with guns pointing out at the rest of America, to the 1 million boob points of light for America, the culmination of the big event, where 1 million colored boob balloons will be launched from the White House lawn, each with a winking light inside, blinking high in the night sky, to spread out over the city and the nation, signifying what this country is all about.
Join us next week for yet another episode of The Americans, and we will see President Cosmo Nutt presenting a Medal of Freedom to the American who found a boob balloon that has traveled the farthest.
Well, it's been another long week in Moon Rock Lake, Ohio, my hometown at the end of the empire. The attacks of 9/11 happened what should seem a long time ago, but it does not. It seems like yesterday. There are people still locked away in Guantanamo. War is still being fought. People being killed, lies being told, new lies, old lies perpetuated, placed on monuments, all connecting in a straight line through the hearts of us all, right to that day, that morning. September 11, 2001 happened everywhere, even in Moon Rock Lake, and now it can be told at least something of how it affected the lives of the people there. Even though it seems not so long ago, the truth. The story of at least a few of the people who lived here during that time, enough time for someone to be born and grow to high school age, enough time for those in high school at the time to have children of their own who don't have any reason to question, to ask questions. And so we could be quiet and let them be comfortable and not knowing. We could do that. Some of us still hear the news reports of those days, quotes we read somewhere playing in our minds like there's a radio somewhere tuned to 12 years ago. You had to be there, as the saying goes, to understand what it was like. Kate Smith on the radio, George Bush on the TV, the towers coming down. There's a radio on somewhere. I hear it. Don't you hear it? We look. We have to look. You always look. Trust yourself. You know more than you think you do. Dr. Benjamin Spock. The car stopped. A small white domestic with rust in the wheel wells. Slowly rolling to a halt at the stop sign. But not in front of the sign. Rather behind it. Perpendicular. At odds with the sign. The car sat with two tires halfway covered by the ditch brome grass. A man pulled himself out of the driver's door and walked around the back of the car, carrying something flimsy in his hand, pinching it with two fingers as the breeze caught it. He stood next to the sign, judging his height by its, looking down the old dirt road to where it was forced to climb a short hill and where the aged path at once grew ancient, with grass down its middle, like an old man's eyebrows, unchecked tufts on both sides. The man wearing a t-shirt, tennis shoes, and green shorts to his knees took two steps to put himself in front of the stop sign. He raised the bumper sticker to eye level and concentrated on tearing off the backing, letting the two slick slips drift into the grass. Carefully, he raised the red sticker with white letters to the top stop sign, smoothed it diagonally across the T and the O, then moved back, careful not to step down into the ditch. We are being lied to, the man read, without moving his lips. The smell of hogs rose the breeze. He looked up at the sound of barking geese, tried to locate the V. He took one step forward to reach up and attempt to smooth the bubble in the middle of the sticker. Secrets love to whisper. At the sound of a helicopter's blades, without looking up, the man strode deliberately to his car. Way out here, that noise only meant someone being rushed to the city hospital after a car crash, a heart attack, or a tractor rollover. He got in, started it up, pulled onto the gravel. Gradually, he accelerated, felt the pedal pull away from his foot to the floor. The man's mouth and eyes went wide as he scrambled to find the cruise control. Keeping one white hand on the wheel, he stretched and clawed down to try to pull the pedal from the floor. The speedometer climbed to 60, 70, then 85 as the car approached an old wooden bridge on a curve. The man tried to push the door open as he fought to stop the car by squeezing the steering wheel and soiling his clothes. Cooper Light strode furiously through the nursing home, stuffing folded newspapers between the doorknobs and the frame, trying to get his route done before school. His two hands worked in tandem, ripping out the favorite grocery ad, stuffing him into his paper bag, then twisting the papers to fit. Stupid old people, he thought, with their flags scotch taped to the door, postcards saying, "God bless America." Sits and does not move. Plays cards alone in the dark. Walks away and cannot return. Cooper played his game of making up Indian names for white people. He delivered the daily paper for over 2 years now, since just before the September 11 attack. Cooper read the propaganda headlines. He'd scanned the underground websites on his computer at home, jammed into the corner, surrounded by boxes like Oswald's sniper nest. He'd want to understand how the editors of the paper he worked for could claim to live in the same world. Nothing ever printed about the new pipeline through Afghanistan, the murder of Paul Wellstone, or the government manipulation of the Trade Center debacle. The Bushes and Cheney probably planned the whole thing years ago. How did it happen the two towers came down almost together, symmetrically in a heap, like when a building's taken down by dynamite? And I'm not getting no freaking smallpox shot. That's just what they want. Fill you full of some Soma Prozac cause cocktail. And then this is perfect, the sick fucks. When you refuse to get the shot, they put you in a detention camp, quarantine, for your own safety, the good of the community. Just like on the day that 9/11 happened, Phil Berrigan was in federal prison for beating a hammer on a nuclear submarine or something, and they put him in isolation for his own safety. Yeah, right. As if he ever was afraid or had any reason to be afraid. The other prisoners would not have taken out some misplaced patriotism on him. They know what time it is. It was because he was a threat to the system. A leader. They fear leaders. Like me. Cooper rolled a paper into a tight tube, placed it expertly at room 419. Without thinking, he grabbed the next paper from his bag, walked down the carpeted walkway, and again thought about what had happened way back then. Cooper had been sitting in the hall at St. Rose Middle School, on the wooden bench left over from the middle school intellectual purges of the McCarthy days. He sat with his legs crossed at the ankles, hands folded in his lap, trying to look unconcerned, watching the sweeping hand on the wall clock, listening to Mrs. Feenstra's English class, smelling the lasagna from the cafeteria. Mr. Schmidt walked by in his gym clothes, whistle around his neck, staring at Cooper's t-shirt, then shook his head at the floor as he kept marching. Cooper put his chin to his chest to again read the shirt, the reason for his being on the pine outside the principal's office. The shirt was white with ketchup stain on the breastbone, surrounded by a penumbra of water from the fountain where Cooper tried to rub it out. Underneath the stain was a black picture of President Bush with a crosshairs on the forehead. Below, it said, "Not my president." And so as soon as Cooper walked into Mr. Freeman's room that morning wearing the same shirt that Freeman had told him yesterday not to wear to school again, Freeman had turned from writing on the chalkboard. People need to ask themselves, would evil men kill to gain absolute power? He stalked toward Cooper, gripped him tightly on the shoulder, and said, "You're coming with me." And that's the news from Moonrock Lake, where all the police and soldiers are thugs, all the journalists and Democrats are cowards, and all the Homeland Security COINTELPRO lone gunmen are about average. And that just about wraps up another episode of the New American Dream Radio Show. We thank you for joining us tonight. We hope you'll be back next week and every week right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Thank you, Mike, and good night.
And thank you, Chuck, for all you do, all the interviews, recordings, all the technical stuff, everything that makes this show possible. And thanks to our guests, Michael Annis, Rosanna Frechette, Bill Ferruggio, and Frank Cordero. Please visit the New American Dream website. You'll find information about our regular guests and show archives, newdream.us, also penmagazine.us. So good night to my friends, Chuck and Lorraine. Stay warm down there. Good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer. Good night, Mark Bingham. Good night, Timothy McVeigh. Good night, Charlie Hebdo. Good night, Don Hawksprung. Good night, Ken Lay. Good night, Muhammad Atta. Good night, Omar Mateen. Good night, Noah Posner. Good night, Crystal Campbell. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.
The night was mighty dark, so you could hardly see, 'cause the moon refused to shine. There's a couple sitting neath a willow tree, for love they part. But little maid was kind of afraid of darkness, so she said, I think. Shine on, harvest moon. See you next week. Thank you for listening.
Night of our lives, but you're gonna let it be the worst.
And I guarantee a week won't go by in your life you won't regret walking out, letting them get the best of you.
Well, I'm not going home.
We've got too far,
and I'm gonna stay right here and fight for this lost cause.
A day may come when the courage of men fails, but it is not this day.
The line must be drawn here, this far, no farther.
I'm not saying it's gonna be easy.
You're gonna work harder than you ever worked before.
But that's fine, we'll just get tougher with it.
If a person grits his teeth and shows real determination,
failure is not an option.
That's how winning is done.
Believe me when I say,
we can break this army here.
And win just one for the Gipper.
But I say to you, what every warrior has known since the beginning of time,
you've got to get mad.
I mean plumb mad dog mean.
If you would be free men, then you must
fight to fulfill that promise. Let us
cut out their living guts
1 inch at a time.
And they will know what we can do.
Let no man forget how menacing we are. We are lions.
You're like a big bear, man.
This is your time.
Seize the day.
Never surrender.
Victory or death.
Patch the Chicago.
Who's with me?
All right,
let's fly!
And gentlemen in England, now abed, shall know my name is the Lord when I tell our enemies that they may take our lives, but they'll never take our Independence Day.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. One world coming together to bring freedom home. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
This is the people's war. It is our war. We are the fighters. Fight it then. Fight it with all that is in us. And may God defend the right.
Warning, warning.
We gotta stop them. Kill us all!
See how the trouble you've started?
Be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they...